It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It's been a year since the shooting at the Orlando gay nightclub, in which 49 people were killed, and it's been nearly 50 years since the Stonewall Rebellion launched the modern gay rights movement. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. June celebrates LGBT Pride Month, and it's been marked by marches and activities around the country. But unlike his predecessor, President Donald Trump has not issued a statement recognizing the month, even as his Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has done so. Over the years, there has been progress, including the end of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in the military and the U.S. Supreme Court decision legalizing same-sex marriage. So what does the world look like for the LGBT community? In our studio this morning, we have Dr. Michelle Schlehoffer, an associate professor and chair of the psychology department at Salisbury University. Also, Dr. Diane Illig, chair of the sociology department, again, on the SU campus. Together, they developed the Safe Spaces program. Dr. Schlehoffer is also on the steering committee of the Lower Shore LGBTQ Coalition, and she's also president of the City of Salisbury's PFLAG chapter, formerly Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. And on the phone with us is Steve Elkins. He's executive director of Camp Rehoboth, which serves the LGBT community there. And welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, Steve, I'm going to start with you. I just sort of outset there the what's kind of the atmosphere that we're looking at in terms of there's been progress, but also we have an administration which has not necessarily been viewed as friendly necessarily to the LGBT community. What does the present look like in terms of the kind of progress that you've made in the past?
Well, you know, the progress, the present and the progress that we've made looks really good despite what we're seeing in this administration. And I say that because every poll you see, every time that the national polls come out, more and more people are coming out in favor of not only equal rights for LGBT citizens, but also in support of same-sex marriage, in support of transgender and gender identities issues. So the public, the groundswell is there. The administration is trying to step backwards.
I saw something this morning,
that even I think the Department of Commerce in their new employee regulations had deleted protection for based on sexual orientation and gender identity.
Diane, how do you see the current atmosphere as we're going into this, at least next 2 to 4 years?
Well, I think that one of the things we always anticipate is anytime you make progress as a marginalized population, there's a backlash against that. And I think that to some extent, we're seeing that backlash, that people feel emboldened to say hostile things and to do hostile things. And that's where rolling back some of the protections that had occurred seems to be coming from.
And Dr. Schlehoffer, what about you? How do you see this?
Well, I would agree with Dr. Illig that anytime there's any kind of social progress, there's usually some form of backlash. And we know that progress towards social justice is not necessarily a straight line. It's more cyclical. So I think that there have been a lot of gains. I think that people are not necessarily going to be as willing to lose those gains now that they have them. But I do see some concerns with the current administration. One of the things that I think is particularly concerning but seems to be under people's radar is that questions regarding LGBTQ status are not being asked anymore in any federal surveys, including the census. And this is significant because really that's our way of documenting the extent of the LGBTQ population and also getting data to highlight disparities and so that we can better serve that population. So the fact that that data is not being collected on a federal level, I do worry that that's going to have long sweeping implications that are going to last after this administration is not in office anymore.
Well, let me ask you, the two of you here in the studio, because you folks work with students. What kind of sense do you get about the student population? We're talking about, obviously, the administration, a president who's 70 years old and counting, to say we're 71, I guess it is now, certainly represents a much older generation. What are you seeing amongst young people, Diane?
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. As has been mentioned, you know, there has been a great deal of progress, and a lot of our younger people are really kind of shrugging shoulders at why is this still an issue. However, there is a very vocal group who feels disenfranchised and feels threatened by this. And so we do have that mixed bag. It's a smaller portion of people who feel like threatened by LGBTQ awareness and growth and access to resources and things that didn't used to be. But as was said, the vast majority of people are supportive of LGBT initiatives, protections for LGBT people.
Let me ask you, either one of you, why do at least a certain number of students think of the LGBT community as a threat?
Because it's a longstanding challenge to their values and their beliefs that they may not have had access to be challenged in the past. They lived in communities, they had families, they belonged to organizations that held similar views. And when they get to college, they're being challenged on those views in an up-close and personal way that they hadn't been before.
See, why don't I ask you about your experience? Obviously, you deal with a wider swath there of a community there, and certainly been certainly highly favorable in terms of the LGBT community up there in Rehoboth. Do you find that there's also a segment, though, that just is not accepting, and why do you think that is? Is it a religious thing, do you think? I mean, how do you read that?
You know, I'm not sure that there's any larger, in fact, I think there's a smaller segment that's unaccepting. I think they're more vocal, as your other guests have said, but I'm of the mindset that when they're vocal, that means that all of a sudden things, that issues that they had kept under the radar, that had been kept under the radar, that they were afraid to even talk about, now they're talking about, and it's safer for us to have people talking than to have people silent but being very opposed to anything we're doing. Mm. So I think in the long run, it comes to our benefit for that. I do know that when I speak, I do diversity training every year for the summer police in Rehoboth, the 25 to 30 or so, mostly college students they bring in as summer to supplement the summer force. When I talk to them, most of them are most concerned about, will I ever be able to pay off my student debt? Am I going to have to live in my parents' house the rest of my life? Will I be able to have a job with any longevity to it? I really don't care who sleeps with who and who's married to who or anything else. In fact, probably 5 years ago, we asked the question of, do you know anybody that's gay or lesbian? Two of the summer police raised their hands and self-identified as being gay. A third raised his hand and said, I'm not gay, but I have two mothers. So the tides have changed, and there's no going back. We're going to see to that.
By the way, let's turn to you, Steve, because you have a situation with Martha Pfeiffer, I guess it is, a teacher there at Cape Henlopen High School. She's resigning. Tell us a little bit about the situation there and what's involved.
We're actually at Camp Rehoboth this Monday night, the 19th, I guess, at 6:30. We are hosting, along with the Delaware ACLU and Equality Delaware, we're hosting a student forum, an LGBTQ forum, really to address the culture in the Cape Henlopen School District. The Cape Henlopen School District is where Rehoboth is located. We're really just holding a forum not to talk about personnel issues, but to talk about the culture in general. There's two sides to all personnel issues. So I'm really steering it away from that we don't have all the information and are not in a position to call anybody on the carpet or to talk about that. We have, Ms. Pfeiffer has been offered access to attorneys to help her, but that's for her to personally decide to do. What we want to do is to make sure that we have a culture where all of our students feel safe and empowered. But you know, at the same time, Don, we have to realize that these are minors. It's the school district's responsibility to make sure that they're safe. It's also the school district's responsibility to make sure that outside influences really are not tainting the way they approach school and the learning ability they have and the ability they have to grow in this knowledge. So we want to make sure that we're hearing both sides. I learned years ago when we first started Camp Rehoboth that when we sit down and talk, it's amazing what we can accomplish. We have a lot more in common than we have that are differences.
Well, let me just follow up on that. What is the atmosphere like? I mean, because Pfeiffer, I guess, was the advisor to the teacher and Gay Student Alliance. It sounds like there's some organization within the school district that there's obviously an open recognition of the gay and lesbian community. And yet we have this tension that seems to at least emerge. Or am I correct?
I think the tension is not as prevalent as you're reading
okay.
in some of the reports.
Yeah, yeah.
The report in the Washington paper was a little one-sided. So I've spoken with other GSA advisors and members of the students that are members of the GSA, and while they love Martha Pfeiffer, and she was is a wonderful teacher, a very talented drama teacher, they realize that they do have more support than some people are acknowledging that they have in the school district.
I want to turn to our guests here, because one of the other things that came up here, of course, is the Wicomico County Public Schools, and I guess it was a May 9th school board meeting, where some students brought up the idea that complaints that they had been bullied. I know that the superintendent, Donna Hanlon, did take them aside and talk to them. Either one of you, what's the situation there? And you've heard, of course, Steve talk about the situation up in the school district there. What sense do you have?
Well, I actually, myself along with John Wright, who's our secretary for PFLAG, met with a couple of Board of Education representatives after that board meeting and spoke with them about it. And there seems to be, you know, untangling what had happened in the school obviously is very difficult, and we weren't personally there, but there seems to be from this an opportunity for growth. So the school actually seems like they want to address the student concerns, obviously, and create a safe atmosphere for the student population. So, you know, of course, it's summer and the school's not in session, but we did talk about ways to make that happen, including in-service days for teachers to get them trained on safe spaces, working more collaboratively with the Gay-Straight Alliance organizations already existing in the Wicomico County public school system, and other ways that we could increase supports for students. But definitely our local school district is clearly very committed to ensuring the safety and comfort of all students in the district. And of course, there's a diverse student body, so that's hard to do, and it's going to create some complexities that need to be worked through. But and from my perspective, they seem to be very willing to progress forward with those conversations and make sure that they're addressing the concerns of students as best that they can.
Is it, from what you can assess, from what students tell you, what kind of atmosphere is there? I mean, obviously there's the administration, of course, that's one level, but then there's the students as well. If you're an LGBT student, what kind of atmosphere, what are you walking into?
Well, again, I'm obviously not an LGBTQ student myself,
right,
in the local school system.
But what do they tell you?
But I can tell you what some of the students, at least the population, yeah, that reach out to PFLAG share with us. So we do hear reports of not necessarily so much overt discrimination that may have been the case in previous generations, but more what we would call a microaggression. So an insult or slight or snub that may or may not be intentional. So we hear things like anti-gay slurs in the schools. We hear things like teachers that don't necessarily address when slurs like that happen. And that could be for a variety of reasons. It may be because the teachers, you know, don't think it's a problem, or it may be because the teachers just don't know how to respond or what they should say or what their legal rights and responsibilities are. So we hear more about insults, slight insults and slight microaggressions, more so than overt acts of discrimination. But it is a concern because even though it's pretty minor on a small scale, if there's repeated exposure to those types of incidents over time, they build up. And one thing we do know from the psychological literature is that consistent exposure to microaggressions and insults of that nature has the same impact on somebody psychologically as if you just overtly discriminated against them. So even though it's more minor in many ways, it is something obviously that needs to be addressed in the school.
Diane, why do you think it is that on a public level you can't say certain things, but then when you get to this lower level of social groups like this, for example, where you're not exposed to the public eye, as it were, people feel freer to say things that maybe they might not say if someone was watching, as it were?
Well, I think that, again, most people are not aware necessarily of what constitutes a slur or a slight to someone else, especially if they're not a member of a marginalized population. So some of the language is such common parlance in our vernacular that people aren't aware that they're making a statement that's going to make somebody feel uncomfortable or even unsafe. And, you know, from a national level, 55% of students are hearing these anti-homophobic rhetoric from faculty and staff in their schools. So it's not just the students, but it's the faculty and staff, which goes back to feeling, as a student, are you supported in this school?
Steve, what about this idea that we have a public eye, and but people in private or casually say things that obviously would not be acceptable if they were if the public spotlight was on them? I mean, I've heard this. Yeah, go ahead.
We see that on social media, especially where you can be anonymous. And it's I was having a conversation, have a 17-year-old nephew who's visiting, and we were talking this morning over breakfast about the anonymity and. He's even aware, you know, if he's on Snapchat all the time or on Instagram or whatever, that he's seeing things that I'm not seeing, and he's not really sharing that information. And the anonymity is what's scary. But aside from the teachers, as they were saying, aside from the teachers that maybe have used slurs or don't realize the impact that they can have, these kids are faced with that at home and in their communities and in their churches, and that's where it's really scary that the teachers who are trying to do the right thing aren't always getting, or quite often are not getting the support from the family structure and from the parents and from others out in outside organizations. That's why I wanted to be real careful with Camp Rehoboth getting involved in this forum on Monday night, that they don't look at us as being an outside entity that's trying to come in and tell them what to do, that they look at us as being somebody that's willing to sit down at the table and see how we can make sure that the best intentions are done for our students to make them safe and empowered. What we're also finding a lot done with the gender identity issues, you know, that's relatively new on the radar for so many people. For years, it was just gay and lesbian, and then all, lesbian, gay, and bisexual, and finally, the T part was added, and we threw the transgender community under the bus quite often in order to make smaller gains. But when people make a mistake using the wrong pronoun or doing something, if they sincerely apologize, every transgender person that I've spoken with says they accept that apology, and they understand that people are trying to do their best. And when we try to do our best, we're going to do much better in our communities.
Well, let me ask you, by the way, Steve, follow up on, because we did a show talking about transgenders, a couple of folks who were transgender. And the thing that really struck me is how quickly this thing has taken off, in which they're now transgender characters on television shows. Big Brother, I think, had a transgender person on their show, widely watched. It seems, I don't know whether it's acceptance, but it seems as if there's more attention now being given to it and perhaps even more acceptance. Do you think that's true? I mean, why do you think that's changed, do you think?
Well, I think one of the things that in some of these instances, instead of being stereotypical characters, for many years when you saw a gay character on a television show, they were the buffoon. They were the sidekick that was being made fun of, the hairdresser, the whatever, as opposed to people from all spectrums of life. And I think on some of these shows and having some of the actors portraying roles just as individuals but not necessarily as a transgender person, and they happen to be transgender, we're opening it up so that we're giving more sensibility to it and more honest approach, and it makes a difference. It took a long time for us to quit using things as jokes and making these people butt of the jokes. And I think the more we do that, the more success we'll have.
By the way, I want to turn to Michelle and Diane, because you folks have created a Safe Spaces program. Tell us a little bit about that. And I can say that when I listen to a lot of the media, particularly conservatives, there's lots of critiques about safe spaces. What is a safe space?
The Safe Space program that we have is a series of workshops around making people aware and making them better allies for the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, questioning, queer community. And so it helps people identify what might be a microaggression, helps people identify where some weaknesses are in their organizations, and what they can do better. So one of the things that many people go back, because we offer this to agencies across the state, what many people do is go back and look at their policies. What do their policies have to say? How inclusive are they? And what steps do they actually have in place for handling an issue when it comes up? So the workshop, the main workshop is being an ally. It's a 3.5-hour workshop that's very interactive, combines data, but also opportunities for people to really grapple with where they are and what they can do.
So, Michelle, what's been the response? I mean, we think about particularly the Eastern Shore as being a fairly conservative area, certainly more conservative than I'm necessarily been used to, but then I grew up in L.A. So what kind of response do you get?
Well, I think the response has been overwhelmingly positive. I mean, as Dr. Illig said, the program is now offered statewide. There's a lot of agencies and organizations, nonprofits, government organizations, state universities and colleges that want this training for their employees. And there's an important reason for that. And it's because even though the Eastern Shore is conservative, LGBTQ people live here. And they have the same federal protections here that they would in any other area of the country. So, you know, businesses and organizations need to be aware of what the current policies and procedures are and how they can best work within those guidelines to support not only LGBTQ people, but all of their employees to have a compliant and well-run workplace and a safe workplace for all. So we've done a lot of trainings on the shore. I think the reception has been, for the most part, overwhelmingly positive. We've been recommended to other groups based on somebody will take our workshop and say, hey, we really need this in this other organization. So the fact that this has grown so large, I think, is indicative of the fact that it's very well received and that people walk away with really tangible, concrete things that they can do to make their workplaces more inclusive and just stronger organizations overall.
If I may, just two follow-ups to that. One, Maryland as a state has very progressive laws on the books. So comparative to other states, we actually have some requirements. So public accommodations, for example, for trans individuals in the state of Maryland is the law, which many people aren't aware of. The other part is that all of the workshops that we've done thus far are just by word of mouth. We have no advertising that we do around these workshops.
Well, we've been speaking with Dr. Michelle Schlehofer. She is associate professor and chair of the psychology department at Salisbury University. Also, Diane Illig, she's chair of the sociology department at NSU campus. Together, by the way, they have developed the Safe Spaces program. And, of course, Dr. Schlehofer is also on the steering committee of the Lower Shore LGBTQ Coalition and also president of the City of Salisbury's PFLAG. Rather busy, I guess you are. And also Steve Elkins, executive director of Camp Rehoboth, which serves the LGBT community there. We appreciate you all just taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Don.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Our human ancestors hunted and gathered. They survived and reproduced. And one day, they began to ask, why? I'm Krista Tippett. Join me on Being, spacious conversation about meaning, faith, and the immensity of 21st century lives. A journey of discovery from American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 7 on NPR News Talk 90.7 FM, putting Delmarva first.
I'm Bill Rudman, inviting you to join me here on WSCL for Footlight Parade. It's all sounds of the American musical, and we cover everything from George Gershwin and Rodgers and Hammerstein to Hamilton. It's laced with my commentary, and if you love musicals, you will love Footlight Parade, Saturday night at 7 on WSCL 89.5, Fine Arts and Culture.
Republican Congressman Andy Harris has easily won re-election. But now there's a Democrat who says she's willing to challenge that winning streak. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. A native Marylander, Allison Galbraith hails from Abington and is not exactly a household name on the Eastern Shore. She owns a small business that specializes in defense program management and federal contracting. In her first ad for the campaign, she takes aim at efforts by the Republican Congress to repeal the Affordable Care Act. On her website, there are photos of her standing beside Maryland Senator Ben Cardin and Congressman Jamie Raskin. But the chances for a Democrat picking up the first district can be seen as a long shot, given that it was designed to be a Republican district by Democrats in Annapolis. And we have Allison in the studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, well, first of all, what sparked you? What decided that you thought that you should run for the office this time out?
It was the attacks on everyday Americans and our way of living. But specifically for me, it was that I have a personal experience with healthcare back in 2008 when my son was just a toddler. My ex switched jobs and we all lost coverage. So I was able to put the kids on M-CHIP. And it's a great program, but when there was no public assistance available to my husband or I. And we made just a little bit too much over the cutoff at something like $50,000 a year for a family of four. And I went on to ehealthinsurance.com, onto the private individual market, to get private policies. And I was able to get my ex a policy. But when I flipped the box from male to female, the prices shot up. And then when I put in that I had had postpartum depression and a C-section, the prices went up even more. And 75% of the policies dropped off. So what I would have been left with was either the high-risk pools, which were also unaffordable to us. We were in our mid-20s. Or going back to work full-time, which is what I ended up doing. So now I own a small business. And the reason I can own a small business is because of the ACA essential benefits. I can go on to the private market and I can actually purchase an affordable policy. And I pay less for my health insurance now than I would have back then trying to buy on the private market. So after the election, I went into Representative Harris's office saying, what are you going to do for women-owned small businesses? Are you going to vote against anything that includes gender rate hikes? Are you going to protect us from pre-existing conditions and make sure that maternity care is still covered, things like that? And I at first got a wish-washy answer, which was, well, I think he's going to support these pre-existing conditions. We're going to cover, pre-existing conditions and kids on the policies until they're 26.
Right, and covering those, yeah.
Hmm?
Covering those, right.
Right. And then I said, all right, well, can I get an appointment with Representative Harris himself? And no. It took weeks. They finally said, well, you can talk to the healthcare liaison. So I talked to the healthcare liaison. He says, well, I think you would have been covered under the high-risk pools. And I said, I know that. I would have needed to wait six months to get any care, and I still couldn't afford it. So it wasn't an option. And all I had done was have a baby, right? And I went back and started a petition for town halls for Harris to show up himself and speak to any of his constituents about what he plans to do with our health care. Still nothing. I finally did get to meet him. And I said, do you promise to vote against anything that includes gender rate hikes? And he said, well, I don't think most people would mind if women paid a little more for health insurance. And I said, women would mind. And then he said, well, you need services that men don't need. And I said, everyone came from a uterus. And she didn't like. and at the same time, I was dealing with my mother in hospice care, and she passed away in March. She was a great advocate. She started healthcare or nursing programs and spent most of her life fighting for healthcare for all. And I just reached a point where I said, enough is enough. Americans, the working Americans, everyday people, they need to be protected. They need somebody who's going to stand up for them. And one of the things that my mother taught me was that just because something is hard doesn't mean it's not worth trying. If you don't try, you know the answer is no.
So what do you make of this discussion on Capitol Hill right now that they're trying to find a replacement for the ACA? I mean, is ACA sufficient for you in terms of what you like to see people have, or do you favor a single-payer system?
I favor a single-payer system. I think that we're going to have to move towards a national health care system. And that's because I don't think that the private insurance companies really can be trusted to protect everyday Americans. They make profits by denying us care. So as long as that's occurring, they're going to deny whatever they can. The AHCA goes and rolls back a lot of those protections, or allows states to request waivers that would allow them to roll back a lot of those protections. And it also cuts the Medicaid funding. And it's going to result in a lot of people losing care, which in this country, to me, is unacceptable. The ability to have health insurance gives people job mobility. For instance, small businesses rely on A lot of small businesses, the very small businesses like mine, rely on the exchanges or the private market to go and purchase these policies. But something that I think is lost on a lot of people is that the cost of providing health insurance to employees is very, very high for small businesses. If you take that burden off of them and just have a slight increase in the Medicare tax or the payroll tax that they're already paying, it costs less for the employers that way. It's better for businesses that there be a national healthcare system. And when you look at the cost of running these businesses, the private companies have overhead rates of between 18 and 19%. And Medicare and Medicaid are between 5 and 6%. It's actually less expensive to have a national system. And there are some things that you simply can't trust private industry to take care of, or it's wholly unreasonable to do cost or price comparisons. For instance, when my mother had her stroke, and she had several, I'm not going to go and call the hospitals and say, how much does it cost if I take her here versus I take her to another one? It's a ridiculous concept for emergency services. And if you're talking about a rural area where you have one hospital within a 50-mile radius, that's the only place that you can take them. So the free market is simply not going to address these healthcare needs in a rural area. And it's unrealistic to think that you could trust them even outside of a rural area.
So one of the big mantras in Capitol Hill these days, certainly with the Republican Congress, has been tax cuts to bring down the rates. And they see government as simply too big. It's inefficient. We got to cut spending because it's a drag on the economy and so on. Do you favor some kind of tax cuts? What kind of policy would you carry out when it comes to tax policy? Would you increase some of the taxes, for example? What would you do?
I would consider increasing taxes on the highest earners. But I think that view is sort of incomplete, right? When you're talking about what you're paying in taxes, it's not just what you're paying in taxes. Your bills are what you're paying in taxes, plus what you're paying for your health insurance, plus what you're paying for your health care costs, plus what you're paying for your housing or your food or anything else, right? So sure, maybe they're talking about lower taxes, but at the same time that they're talking about lower taxes, the cost of everything else for the average consumer is rising. I'm more interested in what everyday Americans are spending total, whether it be coming out of their taxes or whether it be all of these other expenses that we incur. If you move towards federal systems for a lot of those things, then the overall cost for the everyday American is going to be less. I had another thought, but I lost it.
Well, let me ask you this. What do you say to the person who looks at the federal government and says, I don't believe the federal government is very efficient. I think our taxes are too high in part because it just doesn't spend money well, that they don't have the belief in the federal government that you seem to have?
Oh, they're right. It is inefficient.
Oh, there you go.
It is inefficient. So what I do professionally is find efficiencies in the government. There, if you want to talk about deregulation, that's something to consider deregulating. The federal acquisition process, for instance, is incredibly burdensome. It's very complex. It takes a professional to manage a federal grant or a federal contract. It takes a professional to write and bid on one of those. It shouldn't be that complicated. People wonder why the federal government can't keep up with industry in terms of innovation. It's because there's so much bureaucracy, there's so much red tape in doing business with the federal government in the first place. I do think that those things need to be cleaned up, but I also see that as an implementation issue and how the federal government actually works versus a policy question of where do the laws for certain things belong.
So, by the way, in terms of the environment, as you know, we have great discussion here on the Eastern Shore about agriculture and the Chesapeake Bay, pollution. And looking, by the way, at some of your material on the internet, you talk about the environment in terms of investment in technology. I'm just kind of curious, do you think that farmers, say, on the Eastern Shore, overburdened by regulations? Do you think that the watermen are overburdened by regulations, that it's a technological solution? Where are you on that? Because as a congresswoman, you are going to have to deal with the fact that there are some really contentious issues. We just recently had a lot of discussion about phosphorus management, for instance, in terms of the farms and the bleed off into the Chesapeake Bay. What's the ultimate, what's going to guide you in terms of trying to deal with that balance?
I believe that there are technological solutions that would ease the burden of complying with the regulations. There is a reason for the regulations. You know, short-term gains versus long-term gains. The Bay is such a fundamental part of our economy, especially when you're talking about the watermen. You have to have a balance to where you're protecting the Bay and allowing the farmers to continue their business also. And I think that there is a happy medium there, and I think that there are technological solutions that will assist them in that. There are some research and development programs, for instance, that we're looking into ways to take biological waste or runoff or chemicals, things like that, right, that would otherwise, I guess, have to be trucked away and disposed of and turn them into energy. So if we take programs like that and we advance that technology, and then for the smaller farmers that can't afford to pay for these huge investments in technology, things like that, you know, give them tax breaks for those investments or support in purchasing that kind of equipment from the government, then they're able to continue their business. You have less of an environmental impact. The technology sector benefits from it also, and as a whole, all of us benefit from it.
Because you seem to be saying, as I said, that the regulations essentially hurt small farmers, I guess disproportionately, as you say. Well, in terms of particularly agriculture, does that mean that companies like Purdue are sort of they can handle it and it's okay to regulate them at one rate as opposed to the small farmer? I mean,
think a little bit more about that one and look into it. Yes, I think Purdue can handle the regulations a little bit more than the small farmers, or rather, they wouldn't need as much government assistance to implement the, you know, to be compliant with the regulations than the smaller farms might.
So, for instance, some people suggested that this, particularly some of the big companies like Purdue, and particularly in the agriculture business, the poultry business, that they should be paying in a lot more to help out the small farmers on the bottom, or even their contract farmers. You think that's the case, that they could pay out more?
I think that the contracts in a lot of cases are structured in a way that they don't benefit the small farmers, that the small farmers are not being given sufficient options. You know, they're being taken advantage of, really. Mm-hmm. And we need to find a way to fix that too. Now I need to look into the specifics of a lot of those contracts, but I've heard that there's an issue there in terms of their profit, how much they're getting, whether there's anywhere else that they can sell their products or things like that, that definitely need to be looked into as to whether small businesses are being taken advantage of by the bigger companies.
But one final note on that, and I don't know if you're aware of it, but we had a big discussion about large farming poultry operations. These operations are like 6 or 7 houses of chickens, much larger. Sitting, they start moving into next to what was residential areas, even though they're zoned agriculture. You know, they're just small developments. Any sense about how? I'm sure that there's going to be somebody coming into your office if you're a congresswoman and say, "Hey, I got this big thing out here, and I'm getting sick because of it." Any thoughts about whether the federal government should get involved in something at that level, or do you think it should all be taken by the state?
If you know that there's a health concern associated with some particular behavior of a company, then I think that should be regulated federally, mm-hmm. especially when you're talking about companies that cross state lines. I believe that is a federal problem and something that should be addressed at that level. What I would do specifically, I think you'd have to look at the, you know, case by case basis of what's going on there. And it goes back to the idea of sort of the federal government setting like a goal or an objective that must be met, and the local government's deciding how it is that you go about doing that, to give them the flexibility and the communities the flexibility that they need to figure out what works best for them, so long as you're meeting some goal or objective.
I want to turn to education for a moment. It's been obviously a big issue, particularly with Race to the Top, federal funding going to particular schools. They lay out some programs that was under the President Obama's administration. Where are you in terms of federal funding for education, particularly at the school level? And I guess I can ask you, what's your reaction to the person who was appointed Education Secretary, DeVos?
The school vouchers get me worked up. My son attends public schools. I am a product of public universities. Both of my parents, my father worked at a community college for 45 years, and my mother started programs at public universities. So I support public universities. I don't believe that federal dollars should be taken out of our public education system and given to a private or certainly a religious school. If people want to send their children to a religious school, I believe that they should be doing that with their money. That's their choice. But what we need to do is keep the federal funding in our public education system. So I don't support the voucher programs for the pre-K or through 12th grade levels at all. In fact, it concerns me that I need to think about this statement for a minute. I mean, I guess the general takeaway is that it concerns me that public education funding would be pulled out and given to schools that aren't in many states, now Maryland's programs are not that bad, but in many states, not held to the same accountability standards that the other schools are. That is just mind-boggling to me. And sure, people who live in school districts where it's not the greatest, they want to give their child the best that's available, but I think the thing that they don't understand in a lot of cases is that the accountability standards aren't there. Your child can be thrown out of a public school or a religious school, and when they have nothing left to turn to except for the public school, then you want that public school to be strong in the first place so that people don't have to go and pull their child out and send them somewhere else. I think that the investments need to be made in the public schools.
I want to turn, by the way, to gun ownership. The state of Maryland has some fairly tough gun laws and gun control regulations, but we want to talk about it. In your website, you talk about responsible gun ownership is not a threat. Do you favor the kind of regulations, for instance, that we have in Maryland? Would they be applicable to, say, at the national level? I mean, where are you? Because the statement seemed a bit vague to me. Where are you? Are you for the registration and so on? I mean, what's your sense about that?
I have my best friend's husband works for ATF, and I had a long discussion with him, and I said, "What are your actual problems?" And he said that the problems are with the state's reporting. The states are not reporting into the background check system in a manner that we can do an effective federal background check. I think that we need to fully fund ATF as a start. We need to make sure that the states are reporting into those databases so that when you do a background check, you're pulling up all of the relevant information. And we need to strengthen those things that are going to have the most significant impact on who has access to weapons. On the other hand, you know, I enjoy target shooting. I also understand this is a rural district. And so my stepson, his grandparents, they lived in Texas on one of these huge ranches. And when he was just a small kid, maybe like 4 or 5, they gifted him a gun. And, you know, having come from Harford County, I thought, this is nuts. And then after a while, I started thinking about it and wondering, you know, maybe it's not the worst thing in the world if a kid knows how to handle them. They don't just hand them to them. They teach them gun safety. And we can pretend like guns don't exist in our society, but they do. They do. It's there. It's much like sex ed almost, right? You can say abstinence is the answer, but the bottom line is that kids are going to do what kids are going to do, and you need to teach that. You need to mitigate that by being responsible about it. I think that teaching gun safety is wise in an area where you never know whether your kid is going to walk into a house where there are a bunch of weapons. Certainly, you hope that they're locked up, but it's not always the case.
Would you favor, for instance, say, limits on magazines or banning certain kinds of assault rifles, some of the proposals that sort of been put forward in the past? Do you think those are necessary?
Possibly. I think the bigger concern is the background checks and even the, you know, 97% of gun crimes are handguns. And even when you look at the mass shootings, there might have been assault weapons present, but it was handguns that were doing the damage there, right? We need to be a lot more careful with, we need to strengthen our background check and make that so that you don't have them getting into the wrong hands in the first place. In terms of the assault weapon bans, I think that you would have to look at it, and I would say it's certainly the type of thing where I would want to bring in the experts, because as I understand it, a lot of those laws as written do nothing. Like they're not effective. They wouldn't have any impact on the actual gun violence, but certainly it's something that warrants a lot more research. We need to have the CDC looking into the gun violence, and I know that funding and those studies have been cut, and that's something to be concerned about.
We, of course, living now in a very uncertain world. The current president has certainly made a clear shift in foreign policy, whether it's in relationship to NATO, to Russia, and so on. What's your overall sense about U.S. engagement abroad, both diplomatically, obviously, for instance, NATO, but also militarily? How willing are you, for instance, to, say, engage U.S. troops in, say, conflict overseas, whether it's Syria or it's Iraq or Afghanistan?
This is another thing where I would say Department of Defense, a lot of their budget goes to manpower, troops, deployments, things like that, right? Technology, though, is a force multiplier. The better our technology is, the less troops that we ever have to send into a battle. That, I think, needs to be the focus of Department of Defense. In terms of where I stand on it, I would say it certainly avoid it. I mean, if you can, avoid it.
How engaged do you think we should be at the nation state level, whether it's in Afghanistan, which we've been for a long time, Syria, which we just sort of poke at once in a while, or obviously Iraq, we went full bore.
I didn't support going into Iraq. I didn't, and Afghanistan was equally questionable. Certainly, I'm not the one that was there looking at the intel on it. And I'm not a general. I'm not certain what was going into all of those decisions. However, I would say that we need to be really, really careful in terms of getting into those engagements, because they're not short-term things. We've been in there for over a decade now in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I don't know that that was, certainly I think it was foreseeable. I don't think that was the intention. When we started pulling out of there, we just destabilized a region that would have been better off if we hadn't gone in a lot of ways. So, I would say that we just need to I think we need to evaluate that on a case-by-case basis and avoid sending large standing troops into these zones if we can help it.
By the way, in terms of international events, we've had the free trade agreements. As you know, the president backed out of the Asian pact, and there's a lot of discussion about individual, for instance, trading deals with other countries and so on. Where are you, first of all, on free trade? And did you support, for instance, the Trans-Pacific Partnership? Was that something you would have been engaged in? Would you be willing to say, for instance, revisit NAFTA? I mean, those are all things that are going to be sitting on your table one time or another.
So I will say that we live in a global economy. And having worked with Department of Defense a lot, I've been stuck behind the Buy America Act. And I know that that significantly raises the prices of the equipment that we buy. So I don't think that you can limit it entirely. TPP, I would say no. You know, but I don't think that you can just cut those things off entirely, because there are other reasons to be involved in trade with other nations.
Do you think those free trade agreements have basically stolen jobs out of the United States?
Yes, but automation is coming. So let's say that we had kept those manufacturing jobs, or we shut down that trade and then move manufacturing jobs back into the country, and some of them are coming back. I believe that industry's response would simply be to advance the technology for automation in the factories. And I think that we can see this coming in industries like the transportation industry on the 95 corridor. They're doing testing of self-piloted vehicles. For instance, transportation is a huge industry. We can see it coming. So I think that while there are some concerns of jobs being shipped out of the country, I think we also need to be realistic about automation capabilities and what that's going to do to our economy.
I mean, do you think, for instance, the impact of either one of those? Obviously, if Americans lose jobs because they're either not there because of machine or they're not there because they got shipped over, what kind of thoughts do you have about what do you do with the workers now left behind? I mean, you look at Detroit, used to have 2 million people in it, and now it's got 700,000. Much of that is due to the decline, obviously, the U.S. auto industry and the shipping out of overseas. So that's left a lot of people behind. What do we do about them?
I think that you need to retrain people in the up-and-coming fields. You know, or just some other trade, something that they're comfortable in. And I will say that I think that when you're on unemployment, they do offer you certain job training, some of it, but it's usually not for very highly paid jobs. I think that we need to just restructure how that's done so that people are being given education and a skill set that's going to allow them to get back out into the workforce and not just find themselves back on unemployment, you know, down the line. Set them up for success in the long run, even if there's a slightly higher short-term cost of, you know, saying, all right, we understand you're not going to be in the workforce for 18 months because we're going to put you through this program that's going to allow you to support yourself forever. I think that would be a much better approach than what they do a lot of the time now.
Finally, I want to talk about the district, because the district, as mentioned in the opening, the district was drawn in such a way to actually make it much more Republican than when, for instance, the last Democrat won the district. Matter of fact, it was designed, in effect, so that there would be one more Democrat in Congress from Maryland than there had been in the past. Stats I saw, there's something in the neighborhood of like 223,000 Republicans in the district, 176,000 Democrats, 88,000 independents, and about 7,500 others that are affiliated and so on. How do you overcome that kind of party deficit that you're facing in this district?
Well, a lot of it is voter turnout issues. And I think that a lot of the problems we've seen in the past are campaign strategy issues almost. Certainly when it goes to cutting across party lines, I think there are a lot of things that people can agree on. And anti-corruption or consumer protections or just support for the everyday working American, like the little guy in the world, is who needs this assistance. And it's a matter of the personal contact and getting out there and talking to people and saying, look, I actually understand your problems. The things that impact you every day impact me every day. I am just one of the, you know, like working Americans. I have to work. I rely on, I have these problems with healthcare. I have my son's in public school. I understand how these things are. And just talking to people, well, I will say I have Republicans on my team. I have independents on my team. I have Democrats that were Bernie supporters on my team. I have Democrats that were Hillary supporters on my team. And there's nobody that I will not talk to and try and work with and try and come up with some solution. And at the end of the day, and unless you're, the owner of the CEO of some big corporation, I'm probably on your side.
So, because one of the things that I ran across, and I've interviewed another candidate, actually was running in the first district as well on the Democratic side, but Heather Mazira, who ran for governor, she said that the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee is still very old school and won't post cash for races with numbers like the first district on paper. You expect much support, even if you grab the nomination from the Democratic Party, or is this going to be all done at the local level, and you don't really expect a lot of support from the folks in Annapolis and wherever?
She's right. She's right. Mm-hmm. Historically, they've not stepped in. If you have a candidate who's bringing in $250,000 quarterly, then sure, maybe they'll step in. In this type of environment where the Democrats are mobilized now and people understand that we can't stay home, there is a problem, we're being like hijacked here, then I think that there's a higher chance of them getting involved or at least helping in some way. Now, the Maryland Democratic Party has promised that they're not going to leave anybody behind, that they are going to help in District 1. So I think that that's promising. That's a step in the right direction. Am I expecting it? Not necessarily. Am I hopeful that it might come one day? Maybe. Time will tell.
Any thoughts, by the way, how much you have to raise to win this seat, win the nomination of the seat? Or have you set any goals at all yet?
I have...
Not yet.
I have goals.
You have goals?
I have goals, and there's an awful lot that can be done with the... We have a very large volunteer list on the campaign right now. Much larger than I expected to have right now. So I think that that's promising, and you just need to find a way to work with the resources that are available to you. I mean, this is the type of stuff that I talk to my program managers, my clients about. I say, look, maybe you don't have the money, but you have support from this organization, and they can offer this, and do what you can with what you have. So we'll do what we can with what we have, and we're going to give it everything we've got.
We've been speaking with Allison Galbraith. She is running for the Democratic nomination, the first district. If she wins the nomination, of course, more than likely she will be running against the incumbent Republican Congressman, Andy Harris. And we appreciate you stopping by and talking with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.